the following contains strong language and adult content. We tried to tell our hosts that they'll be talking about manga targeted at Japanese teenage boys, but they demanded access to what they call fuck words. So, here we are. Listener discretion is advised.
How's it going, everyone? And welcome to another episode of the Shonen Fiasco Show, the number one book club for the self-loathing weeb. I am your, I don't feel like doing a fancy jingle for this one, host, Adam Tetramore.
And I'm your somewhat fancy jingle with an excitable voice, co-host, Alex Hill.
And we are deflating. is a deflation nation week, you know what I mean? This is I did my warm-ups, I really did, Alex, and it's not taking the effect that I needed to at the start of this. I didn't even come in with a, like, I'm the host with the mostest made for roasting. I just kind of phoned it in. I'm sorry for that.
No, that's okay. I mean, it's definitely been sort of one of those weeks all around for a lot of folks. I did try to get my sillies on when I was reading through this. I tried to just imagine every once in a while the main character saying, believe it, like Naruto. You know you do what you can. You do what you got to do to get through.
The Shonen Jump characters, they make catchphrases seem so appealing, but when you're like super 2020 depressed, I'm going to be king of the pirates does nothing to really pique your mood up. Like, I've tried everything. I've done the believe it. I've done just yelling at the top of my lungs and having my hair glow. I've done everything I can to get through this funk, but like all it's done is change my hair and beef my muscles up a bit, and I'm still depressed.
It still doesn't get rid of the existential dread. One thing that's helped me is I watched the entirety of Avatar, and I had a great time. The Last Airbender, that is.
How do you like Avatar The Last Airbender?
I loved it. I thought it was great all around, and it is kind of cool because I watched a H-Bomber Guy video of him going through the series Ruby, and there's a lot of comparisons between it and Avatar. And for story-wise and analysis-wise, both watching that show and watching that video about two different series helped put things in perspective and gave me some extra tools that I thought were neat to, you know, dive into series that are nowhere near either of those two, like the one we're going to talk about today.
It's actually interesting you brought up H-Bomber Guy, because I had to think that this series that we'll be talking about today would have been prime fodder for a leftist criticism YouTuber like H-Bomber Guy, but I don't feel like they would subject themselves to something like this just for the sake of like critiquing it. So that's where we have to come in. The pressure is on, if you were to ask me, because this is a series that I think in the West, for those that have read it, this one hits on like, oh, Japan's a little different from us in terms of what gets greenlit, huh?
I could not imagine, when I finished the series, I could not imagine something with similar themes flying on Cartoon Network or Nickelodeon or something. Like, there's no way any of this would have even come close to flying.
I say, with that, let's go ahead and get to the pitch. Tokyo, 2049. Thanks to the Galapagos reform enacted by the government, Russia, China, America, and Japan are now connected by a hyperloop system. This globalization has turned Tokyo into the most crime-ridden city in the world. To fight the rising crime, those who have been working in the shadows since the Sengoku period are needed. They are the Shinobi. Authored by Yuki Tanaka with art by Kento Matsura, this is Tokyo Shinobi Squad.
Oh boy.
What a basic ass pitch.
Yeah.
Oh, hey.
Welcome
in
to
the future.
Shit sucks. All right, go.
Really,
oh yeah,
just...
wait, hold up, there's ninjas. Shit sucks, that's the future, and there's ninjas.
Elon Musk should have just been that.
Elon Musk got really tired of putting the Hyperloop underground and decided to put it above ground like a loser.
Made it into a Futurama tube. You just pop in and just fly around in. It sucks, though. I hate it.
I hate it. These tubes weren't like I thought it would be in Mario.
God, I want to rewrite this pitch now and just have it be, welcome to the future. It sucks. This is authored by Yuki Tanaka, and just go from there. Oh, man.
But an accurate one.
Tokyo Shinobi Squad ran in Weekly Shonen Jump between June 2nd and December 9th of 2019. The series consists of 27 chapters and 3 volumes. The entire series can be found on the Shonen Jump app. There are no fun facts about Tokyo Shinobi Squad. This is the debut series for writer-artist duo Yuki Tanaka and Kento Matsura. That's the pitch. It's the future. It sucks. Does this do anything for you in 2020? Do you really need a series to tell you it gets worse?
When this ran in 2019, maybe this would have like slightly caught me in, but not really. We already knew shit hit the fan. But in 2020, I'm just like, oh yeah, you think it's rough?
You think it's rough? 2049. Oh, what? It does feel like that because anytime a character has fun in any way in this series, I'm like, oh, bullshit. This is a dystopian future.
Yeah.
This series is basically a make it or break it for anyone that reads the first chapter. If you don't like the first chapter, you're not going to like the series. And we'll be talking about this first chapter because it's a doozy. Oh, I'm so excited to talk about this series. I'm back up. I'm getting the serotonin right now from this schadenfreude of just, God, the series. Oh, fuck. I don't want to be a dunk tuber, but I'm going to be a dunk tuber for this one.
I don't want to dunk too hard. And I know I can be kind of harsh, but just you wait.
All right. We start with the series in its opening chapters 1-5. We are first introduced to our setting. The city of Tokyo, nearly 30 years in the future, depicted as a neon-besotted urban sprawl straight out of Blade Runner. Gunshots and burning rubber echo out as a car chase plays out on the highway. The pursuer of the chase, a nefarious-looking thug, hangs his body out of the window as he fires his handgun recklessly at the lead car. A mysterious man on the overpass above looks down at the violence with disgust. We get a close-up of the spectator and see a blonde-haired young man with a scar across his face, holding on to caltrops as he grumbles to himself. What's become of this country? So much for globalization.
I can't believe that's the first line of this manga.
Ooh, man, if you don't like this protagonist now, it doesn't get better. But reading this full page spread of this guy, just so much for globalization, like nationalists Shadow the Hedgehog.
No.
Filled me with a level of disgust and amusement that not a lot of page turns have done for me in a long time. It's like, oh, this is the manga. We're doing it. It's happening, Alex. We're reading Tokyo Shinobi Squad.
Oh boy.
What's your first thought?
I had heard things, but no one had really told me a whole lot of what to expect. But when I open the first page and it's just like, it's that line, I just sighed and was like, yeah, not a good look for your pro tag in the first minute.
Not a good look for your pro tag in a series that's being translated into English for a global audience.
The irony of that in this tickles me. I can't believe they ran this.
They ran this and like translated it, and it's amazing to me.
I'm just thinking of the writer just being like, if this is what he wants to say in the opening, he's just like, but damn, I need them to make my money. Please give me money.
And then
the old men at Shonen Jump are looking at the opening line like, that sounds good. Keep going.
We can market that.
Well, yeah, we can sell the shit out of that.
The young man interferes with the chase and with the use of a rigged lighter and some caltrops, destroys the pursuing vehicle with ease. We then cut to narration informing us of how Tokyo in 2049 came to be so dangerous. We learn that at some point in the past, the Prime Minister of Japan, who looks suspiciously like the current Prime Minister of Japan, approved a massive project that would create Futurama speed tubes connecting Japan with Russia, China, and the US. This supposedly led to the influx of massacres, slums, and terrorist groups that would cause Japan to be the most crime-ridden country on the planet. Man, we gotta do a quick writing 101 thing here, okay?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because this series says, in the past, Japan made access to other nations, you know, more accessible. Like, we can now get to Japan easier, and now Japan is a shithole. First off, someone might want to tell the author of this series that airplanes exist.
Yeah.
That there is, in fact, a way that I personally can go to Japan at a pretty affordable... Now, personally, okay, I'm American. I actually can't get to Japan right now.
And we can't get anywhere right now.
I can't go anywhere right now. But if somebody from Russia or China wanted to go to Japan, then they'll go to Japan. It's fine. But I'm guessing the main issue is the fact that Japan has open borders with these countries, I think is what this author is trying to explain.
Yeah, and they never go into like more detail than this. They're kind of just like, he let Elon Musk make the tunnels and then everything went to hell.
But here is the important thing to remember whenever you are coming up with a premise is that every single premise is at some point X happened and because of that, Y happened. Okay?
Yes.
With the Matrix says, mm-hmm. long ago, machines and humans had a war and the machines won. Therefore, the machines now use humans as a slave race, okay? What this series tries to do is the equivalent of if the Matrix was like, in the 90s, man created artificial intelligence, and then because of that, we're all slave race to the fucking robots.
Yeah, there's a bit of a jump there.
All you're doing is hurting yourself, because if you want to do a nationalist manga where like, oh, we opened the borders and it came to shit and whatnot, that's fine. But you're missing out on a lot of fun little story details that happened in between.
Right. I mean, and with a lot of things in this sort of topic, it's just not very well thought out. He wants you to focus on the shock of the crime and all that.
In this new lawless age, a profession of the past has gained new popularity as mercenaries, the profession of shinobi. This brings us back to our nationalist ninja, Jin Narumi, as he enjoys lunch at a ramen stand after stopping the criminal. They just kind of cut to after the fact, and that's going to be weird in a second, but, you know, Jin blew up a car, apparently fought somebody, and now he's just having lunch.
Just chilling out, having lunch.
The ramen stand operator chastises Jin for using ninpo, or ninja arts, in public, and for not taking on more lucrative contracts, as shinobis often do. Jin doesn't want to hear any of it, however. He didn't become a shinobi for the money, after all. He became a shinobi to help people.
Ah,
and then he proceeds to be like, hey, by the way, can you pay for my tab here for this ramen and whatnot? Like,
yeah, he stiffs him. He stiffs him, and then it's like alluded to that he stiffed him before.
Yeah, he's just like, I don't need money. I want to help people. By the way, I know you work really hard to make this business work, but you want to keep giving me free food?
Not only does he talk about, you know, I want to help people, but he talks about, like, his honor and all that kind of stuff, and then just immediately undercuts it.
A boy by the name of N approaches the ramen stall, shares a greeting in Thai, and gives thanks to Jin for saving his life. N, despite his age, was the one being chased on the highway earlier. N then asks Jin if he could be hired for a job. Jin is dismissive at first, but that tone changes when N reveals that he is in possession of a ninpo scroll. We then cut to the red light district of Shinjuku. The thug from before has apparently safely retreated and is now concocting a new plan with his goons to extract the ninpo scroll from N. So the guy's perfectly okay after a car explosion. He's just back at the headquarters and like, all right, let's do it again.
Yeah,
so
just a flesh wound. I'm already back making plans. I didn't even stop at a ramen shop. I went straight back.
And it's funny because the rest of the chapter is we have to find this evil guy to stop him from chasing our new friend. He was right there. You let him go.
Yeah, it's like you bunced it, man.
You really bunched this one.
So my theory on this is that when Jin blows up the car, he turns away and doesn't look at the car exploding because that's what cool guys do.
Doesn't, you're right.
Doesn't
oh,
realize
shit.
That everyone ran away and he just blew up an empty-ass car.
Yeah. He didn't check his surroundings and failed the perception check. God. Our villain explains that ninpo scrolls provide special powers to those who master their techniques. This is demonstrated when the thug savagely murders a sex worker by impaling her with a grotesque alien appendage.
If you didn't know already, he's the bad guy.
But yeah, basically this guy shows up to be like, hey, Nimpo Scrolls are actually superpowers, so we're not Naruto, we're My Hero Academia. So get it right, Shonen Fiasco Show. How dare you tell us we're ripping off Naruto? We cut back to Jin and N as they make their way through the back alleys. N explains that his father was a shinobi, that he was given the scroll before being separated from his family, and that it's his goal to become a shinobi himself one day. Jin, taking pity on the kid, decides to take the job offer. But first, they need to stop by a hotel to see one of Jin's teammates, a beautiful woman by the name of Papillon. With her help, the gang are able to identify the man chasing N as a rogue shinobi by the name of Shuriken.
Of course, that's his name.
We get some banter where Jin and Papillon literally take turns explaining their characters to N, while he just stands there admiring how cool these characters are. I hate this scene. I hate this manga. Writing 101. Show, don't tell. This motherfucker got national publication, an English translation, like worldwide access. And he's out here just having the characters say, oh, well, Jin's, you know, a little unreliable and irresponsible, but he has a good heart and tries his best. Yeah, and Papillon is, you know, a really cold, hearted bitch towards me, but, you know, she's as smart as a whip and da-da-da-da. Show me! Yeah. What are you doing just sitting here, like, describing your character traits in the first chapter? I'm not expecting the fucking most amazing story on the planet, but you have an opportunity in a visual medium to show me these characteristics. Why are we sitting down and just stating out in the open, here are our tropes?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's so lazy to see, like, this is the entire bit of these characters. It's lazy writing. It's boring. And yeah, I can't believe that someone in Shonen Jump read this first chapter, got to this part, and were like, yeah, we'll pitch it.
Because this is the first chapter that it goes through everyone, right? You don't have a serialization yet. You have to kind of send in like a storyboard for your editor to be like, okay, well, let me send this in to the editor-in-chief. And the editor-in-chief reads it and is like, okay, that seems pretty good. I don't want to rag on the writer or the artist on any of these series because it's their dream to do this. But here's a quick cliff notes. If I'm the editor of Shonen Jump and somebody brings to me a series in which the characters sit and explain their character tropes to each other, I'm throwing it in the garbage and telling them try again. I'm so excited to read 26 more chapters of this.
Oh boy.
This is a blast. Later, Jin and Papillon are talking privately about sharing the same conviction to protect N and take out Shuriken, but they're soon interrupted by Shuriken and his Power Ranger Putty Patrol-looking cronies crashing through the window. Jin takes the goons out one by one using his ninpo power of controlling magnetism and electricity, but the cronies still bought enough time for the rest of Shuriken's gang to kidnap N.
This whole scene also made me frustrated because, like, you know, at first they're sitting there talking while Inn's, you know, going and doing whatever, and they're just like, you know, he's a good kid. Like we're gonna protect him, and that comes out of nowhere because there's no build up or anything. They just met the kid yesterday at a McDonald's. The dudes come in and the fight scene's like meh. The powers are meh.
Yeah, I don't think people in 2020 are going to be impressed with electricity powers for your protagonist. Jin gives chase after the gang, but gets stopped by a sound-based ninpo user by the name of Sina, who, by the way, has a much more interesting power overall.
Yeah.
It's not a unique power, but it's probably the one superpower that's used throughout the entirety of the series in the most, like, interesting way. We see the rest of Shuriken's gang taking in outside where the gang leader starts beating up and interrogating the poor boy. The interrogation gets interrupted by a beaten-up Sina, warning the rest of the gang that they've made a mistake and attacked Jin Narumi's squad. It would seem that Jin is notorious in Japan as an up-and-coming force for everything good and honorable in the shinobi world. He is also rumored to be involved in something called the Justin Bieber incident. And they have a little panel with Justin's face just
they do.
Taking a look at us. And,
I can't believe.
So, for the most part, I'm looking at the series like, okay, whatever, it's fantasy. No. This author says, I'm going to show you that, you know, this is the real world. It's the Justin Bieber's here and Jackson Pollock paintings are here. And it goes out of its way to reference things in our real world. And it makes me hate it even more.
Well, I have to give him a little credit because imagining, you know, 20 years from now, a world where Justin Bieber still looks like a teenager, like he's immortal. That might be a little scary. Those implications of Justin Bieber being immortal is a little scary.
How old would Justin Bieber be by the time 2049 hits? Let me... Hold on a second.
Now you're curious.
Yeah, because you know what? That's a good point. Like, is this, like, happening at a retirement home? He's just... Because he's currently 26. 30 years from now, he'll be 56. So he'll be 55 years old.
Yeah.
By the time this happens. I'm guessing this happens sometimes before 2049. But Jin himself is already a super... He's 19 years old, right?
Yeah.
So if he's causing international incidences, it couldn't have been for too long. So this guy is being notorious for harassing, like, a 50-year-old fucking pop star.
A washed-up pop star, like...
I guess they do show an older picture of him, but not 55.
No, yeah. He doesn't look that much older. Like, you could have picked other people to name drop.
If you really want to be a famous shinobi, you gotta harass Britney Spears. That's the real way you gotta do it. Justin Bieber, small fry.
Small fry. I mean, you gotta be a top-tier shinobi to break into the Spears compound and fight her dad.
Yeah, the Spears compound? I would kill for that arc. Just we gotta break into the Spears compound. Ah, shit.
That would make for a more interesting story.
After wiping out the rest of Shuriken's gang, Jin faces off with the villain, who reveals his Ninpo power of transforming his blood into iron that he can then control. N tells Jin to run, but Jin stands his ground and reassures N with a smile. Our hero then proceeds to defeat Shuriken with a combination of blinding speed and an electromagnetic Kamehameha. After the battle, Jin, recognizing the strength of N's scroll and the substantial danger he's in because of it, offers the boy a spot on his squad, which N accepts. Chapter 2 starts 2 days after Shuriken's attack. Jin has been summoned for a meeting at City Hall and decides to take N along. They meet with a government official in charge of shinobi affairs who asks Jin to take on more work. Jin responds by mocking the official and knocking down the Jackson Pollock painting in the office. Like a true rebel.
I feel like the author like wanted to think about what edgy children would like freak out about and be like, wow, they're the coolest.
Everyone's gone through that. Everyone had their Linkin Park phase or their... I'm going to support Donald Trump because it's a meme phase, you know. That's what cringe is for. Looking back and saying, oh my God, I used to be in fascism. Fuck. Things you did as a kid that you look back on, you're like, God, I was really into goth and really into emo for such a long time. And it's just, that's not me anymore. I feel bad for like Zoomers because for them, it's like, oh my God, I posted about Ben Shapiro for like 2 years straight.
Oh my gosh.
Oh God. It's absolutely going to happen. I don't want to rag on you young budding conservative pundits, but it is potentially a phase for some of you, and it's okay, all right? Everyone has that phase, so we'll see you on the other side at some point, man. After the meeting, Jin and N run into a sobbing young woman at an abandoned arcade district. The woman explains that the Yakuza have taken the area over, and the police are doing nothing about it. Oh, no. Jin decides to help out by beating the snot out of the Yakuza when they show up to demolish the district. Throughout the fight, N thinks about how much Jin embodies a righteous heart and just how cool he is in general. N is an interesting case because we are ragging on the series for being a, you know, nationalist Naruto. But N is the rare example of a person of color outside of Japan that's being represented in Shonen Jump. He's a Thai boy that, you know, speaks his native tongue. But he kind of just shows up to act as the audience surrogate.
Yeah.
With the audience supposedly going, he's so cool! He's the coolest protagonist! And we actually have little bits of dialogue that's just like, God, I just love how cool he is! And that's it? That's his character?
He's the coolest, he's the greatest, he's righteous, and they actually use that word, in a way where he's telling you how to think. He's telling, the author is telling you how you should react to this character. I'd rather have situations happen and there be some sort of conflict, and then I get to decide for myself.
Chapter 3 starts a few more days after the last chapter. Jin decides to take N to the official hideout of his squad. It's there that we meet Taiga Shimizu, a dapper and no-nonsense individual who immediately chastises Jin for the messes he's made recently. Taiga is at first cold towards N, but decides to enlist the boy's help with an infiltration job after learning that N's coveted Ninpo scroll grants him the power of perfect memory and recall. That's actually a cool power.
Yeah, that is a cool power.
Jin, Taiga, and N proceed with their mission of infiltrating a massive research facility in order to retrieve stolen stem cell research notes. They're not able to sneak into the restricted areas of the building for long, as a fight breaks out on the way to their quarry. This is where we see Taiga's Ninpo, the ability to take on the physical features of a tiger and enhance his strength.
I get it. Taiga? Tiger?
Taiga? Tiger? Uh-huh. Listen, furries are in 2020 for anime.
They absolutely are. Furries are absolutely in. Oh my goodness.
Now here's the problem. This is one of the worst looking furries I've seen in a long time. Basically, the tiger form is my face gets little snarled muffs and whiskers, and I get cat eyes.
Yeah.
And then I'm just a regular dude beyond that. This is ugly.
It's ugly. He just like, I'm not even sure he actually has an Ninpo. I think he just pulls out one of those rubber tiger masks you buy at like Kmart and slaps
it on.
It
does look like that. After some resistance, the gang are able to arrive at the room containing the stolen data. There they find the nefarious scientist who made off with the research, surrounded by armed guards. The scientist is confident of his position. He warns our heroes that using electricity haphazardly will result in the complete destruction of the data, since it's on the computers, so you can't do that. No electricity allowed.
That's right, it'll zap everything, even in the cloud, 20 years in the future.
Jin takes advantage of this by telling N to memorize all of the research while he and Taiga back him up. Once N finishes memorizing nearly a petabyte of data, Jin unleashes an electromagnetic pulse to destroy every computer in the building. We do get, you know, another guy with the Ninpo ability that's just, he's made of stone or something. I don't remember. Whatever.
He was boring.
One thing I love about this, and this series is so weird about this, the choreography of this fight scene is odd because it starts with our gang enters the room. We have a monologue with the scientist who says, haha, you can't use electricity powers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, like, flanked by a line of armed dudes with, like, guns and shit.
Right.
Just ready to take out these three, you know, teenagers. And then Jin just walks up to the podium, just walks past the whole fucking crowd, and says, all right, get over here and memorize the fucking thing,
yeah.
Guy.
He literally does.
What are the goons for?
They were just like,
these are,
oh, he's just walking. We can't do anything.
Yeah, he's too cool. Like, everyone has the same thing as N has. Just like, he's just so cool. I don't want to shoot him. Look at his character design. He's a scar and everything. God, I love him.
Oh, my God.
Our heroes transcribe the research to their eternally grateful clients. And after everything they've gone through, Taiga finally warms up to N as a squad mate. Hooray, you get to be part of the squad.
Taiga's like, oh, you're useful now. I like you.
Yeah, you're useful. I can exploit you, young child. Excellent.
In my mind, I just imagine the voice of Taiga also being the musician rapper Taiga, and
oh right,
and just like the same voices in that song Rack City. I don't know why. That's just my headcanon for him forever.
Now that is a bit of a deep reference. You want to do a quick cover of that song for our podcast people know what you're talking about?
Oh my gosh! Huh? No, I don't. I don't.
It's getting
to
cut
it.
Then. No one knows what you're talking about. Wasted airtime. Sorry, everyone. My co-host refuses to do a rap song to let you all.
I only know a little bit, and you'll see how painfully Casper White I am if I sing this.
What a shame! I like that joke too, but I guess it's got to get cut for those that don't know who Taiga is. Oh man, you were really looking forward to telling it, but I guess your refusal to spit fire for me has ruined the podcast once again. This takes us to the first actual arc of the series, chapters 6 through 12. I called this one the cool fashion arc. I think it's clever. 4 days after their infiltration mission, Jin and Papillon are hired to act as bodyguards for a runway model by the name of Maki Mizuno. In their meeting, Maki's agent explains his client's appearance in an upcoming fashion show, the efforts of a larger talent agency towards assassinating her, and the strained relationship he shares with his client, who he sees as a daughter. Seeing as they're this girl's last hope, Jin and Papillon take the job. We then cut to a hotel building where we are introduced to the villain of this arc, the cold-blooded celebrity assassin Hyosoi Nagumo, as he effortlessly disposes of a couple of bystanders with his ice powers. Oh, spooky.
He's so spooky.
Eventually, Maki is attacked by Hyosoi's goons, only for them to be repelled by Papillon and her Ninpo power of fabric manipulation. Another freaking My Hero Academia power, but, you know, at least it's not an X-Men power, as far as I know. Let's be honest here. This is a cool power to show Papillon's body in interesting ways, and, you know, sure, I mean, that's whatever. Hey, listen, adult woman fan service. You get the prize. You get the... You did it. You didn't give us fan service at the high school.
Right,
so, hip, hip, hooray.
Small victory there, I guess.
After dealing with a wave of cronies, Jin and Papillon come face-to-face with Hyosoi. This is an interesting interaction just because they actually do something kind of weird and upsetting with this villain who proceeds to freeze one of his goons. And then he's got, like, a crony there that's like his second in command with a ice shredder to make little snow cones that he just eats.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a dumb gimmick, but I said, you know what? That's kind of cool. That's the best thing I could say about it is that it's memorable.
It was really weird. I wasn't expecting that.
Just before things start escalating, Hyosoi orders a tactical retreat and promises to show Jin's place the next time they meet. It apparently won't be too long till then because Maki disappears from her room the very next night. Hyosoi and his employer, a drugged-up, Prada-wearing devil by the name of Hanabel, bait Maki by kidnapping her agent and sending her a ransom note. Maki and her agent reunite and bond over the traumatic experience while falling directly into our villain's trap. Without any way to find Maki on their own, our heroes turn to a former foe, the sound shinobi Sina, in order to get a bead on their client's location. They bring Sina back. I don't know why they bring her back, I guess just to be like, hey, you know, she still exists and that's how shinobi do things. Sometimes they beat up each other and, you know, they end up working together later on and no healings are hurt. But so much of the series is about Jin, whenever something happens to a squad mate or to a client or to a friend, he's like, I will never forgive them. And it's like, well... You know, we kind of need her to help us out here.
Until later, so, it's like, oh, yeah, I kind of need her power to locate this stuff.
I'll be pissed later, I guess. It's fine. We then cut back to the villains. And just before Hyosoi is able to land a killing blow on Maki's agent, Jin comes out from the ceiling with a massive punch straight to the villain's face. In their final showdown, Jin gets pushed to the limit by the assassin. But our hero eventually comes out on top with a reckless headbutt that knocks Hyosoi out. This fight is, it's a bit on the bland end because we get a little bit of action. And then we cut over to Hisoi's number two guy fighting Papillon, except they don't. All that is just, oh, here's this guy's power of, like, extending his tongue. And, you know, they talk about how that's a power he has.
No, it's super frustrating. Like, just like in our last episode when we looked at Zipman, there's just a whole lot left out. And it's just like, it was almost so jarring that I had to go back and, like, I thought I skipped a page.
Yeah, so that's what I thought too. I thought, like, I missed
a chapter.
I had to
go back and I was like, I missed something. And I was like, nope, this is actually how it is.
And then the fight ends and the second in command guy is just like, wow, he does what every other character does. He's like, oh, he's so cool. Wow. Man, my boss is such an idiot. Oh, fuck this guy. And we also get a scene where this guy has a Call of Duty dropping the grenade after you die type move where he freezes the interior of this storage facility so that nobody can escape. And then, oh, Taiga and N show up to save the day because why not?
They just kind of... Do.
They super quickly explain, like, oh, how are you here? Oh, Sina told us, but, you know, whatever. Just hurry up because we got to go to a fashion show. And sure enough, Maki and her agent have been saved, and the arc ends with a relatively conventional fashion show considering the dystopian setting. I guess, you know, 30 years of crime and poverty doesn't fuck with fashion. Fashion just lives through everything.
Fashion lives forever.
This arc is not interesting. I know I'm supposed to be more critically productive than that. I'm not supposed to be the it bad guy, but there's nothing really inherently awful about this arc. It's just, I don't know why I'm here, and I don't know why other people are here.
Yeah, who's reading this still? There's no development going on. The characters kind of show up, just kind of say whatever. The fight scenes don't really happen. You're there for the first and last punch.
And not to mention, we have the subplot with the agent and the model where we have a rebellious daughter and a dad that cares a lot, and they're put in a dangerous situation. The dad is honest about, I really care about you. And the daughter says, oh, I'm sorry I said those mean things to you. Blah, 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 blah. I'm sure somebody out there is, you know, their heartstrings are being pulled by a dad trying to reach out to their daughter's subplot because they haven't seen Taken or like half of all media. But this arc is a drag.
It is a drag.
We go to a much more exciting arc, but probably for the wrong reasons, with the Orochi Quarter arc, chapters 13 through 22. The arc starts with Jin and En answering a summons at the Shinobi Union headquarters. Their squad is due for a seminar of sorts, especially after taking down the notorious Hyosui. We're shown a number of quirky-looking characters, however, only a handful of them are relevant to this arc, trying to do like the Hunter thing where we see a bunch of interesting designs and like, ooh, what powers do they have, but you know, we don't care to see most of them, so whatever. One of these characters is Kenryu Oniwa, a comic relief shinobi with a delinquent complex. His character traits include being attracted to Papillon and, as Jin puts it, being annoying.
That's it. That's his entire character. He opens up annoying and kind of gross.
And he's dressed like every delinquent ever, which, sure, whatever. A mysterious robotic geisha, acting as the administrator of the seminar for this lot of shinobi, informs the group that they must split up into teams and complete a mission in order for their squads to be evaluated. Jin and En decide to team up with Kenryu and his squadmate, the super serious Tetsu, in order to retrieve chemical weapons that are reportedly stolen from a Shinobi Union armored truck.
When they're describing like what's going on here, the one character who has no fucking clue what's happening right now is En. We get the exposition of what this is and why through like two random ass guards when we could be getting this exposition from Jin teaching En or something like that.
Well, Jin's too cool for exposition, remember?
Yeah, that's right. He's too shallow for that.
Jin will talk about every character's TV tropes page, and that's about it. Everything else about the world, he's like, whatever. It's like the role of every other character is to be like, here is this facet of the world. And Jin is like, whatever, it sucks. I hate this world. It's like, I agree, Jin. I agree. It's not interesting and I don't care for it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're on the same page with me in that regard. That's real good to get. That's a real good trait of your protagonist. It's just, I hate the story I'm in. Apparently, because the task of collecting stolen chemical weapons wasn't hard enough, Jin and the gang are also met with a number of tests during their investigation, courtesy of the Shinobi Union. So, we have this association that's about evaluating shinobi to see if they are following rules and if they can achieve a certain rank like a Naruto, where you're like a Genin and a Chunin, except now it's just letters. You want to be the A rank shinobi squad, and right now, all y'all are D rank, and y'all gotta go up the ranks, okay? So here is our Chunin exam arc where you try to do that, and our Chunin exam is an actual crime that's happening right now that you need to solve. Okay. That makes sense because it's a crime-ridden world, so you might as well take advantage of the shinobi that are being evaluated by actually getting them to solve a mystery of some kind while monitoring them. But then these fucking assholes at the Shinobi Union say, here are some fucking obstacles to solve that, like, there's an actual crime happening, and then there's like, oh, but you know what? We're just going to bullshit with you to...
We're also going to fuck with you.
And like, if you solve my puzzle, I'll tell you the next place to go. If you know the next place to go to solve this actual crime, y'all should be like fucking solving the actual crime, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's if like, you already have all the breadcrumbs put together.
It's like, I'll tell you where to go if you beat me. It's like... Are we on the clock here? Didn't they steal chemical weapons?
You stole chemical... Terrorists have stolen chemical weapons, but sure, let's get the TSA to run through, like, a wipeout course before they can, like, catch the guy before he gets onto the plane. They do an investigation, and the way they go to do the investigation is they go to a hotel that the Shinobi Union owns. that's just a secret, you know, a shinobi base that you can go to and access. I don't know what they call it. They call it, it's just the shinobi dark web. And this thing is just an illegal web service that allows you to search up any government secret on the planet. And you can find anything from upcoming business announcements or upcoming arrests or investigations to grand global espionage and everything. And then one of the guys, Tetsu, is in the back. He's like, hey, can't you use this to find out the secrets of Area 51? And Jin's like, yeah, but I don't give a shit. Telling me that you want to tell me this is the real world. And in the real world, there's just a dark web Google where you could find every single like government secret. How is that not the premise of your series?
Right.
There is a WikiLeaks times 1,000 that has complete access to all information on the planet. Every single government agency knows about it because they oversee the shinobi, but they're cool with it. So you have a world in which everyone has access to information about every single wrongdoing from every single business and government agency, and you use it for a gag.
It's like the author watched that one Keanu Reeves movie where he like shoots up everybody and goes to the hotel and has a bunch of cool fights.
Yeah.
I don't remember what it's called.
It's very John Wick. I know exactly
John
what you're
Wick,
talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, just like he watched John Wick once and was like, that's cool. I'll take a little bit of part of that and throw it in here randomly.
But that is an example of a secret society of assassins done well. And a big part of that is the fact that the government doesn't know about it. That's how secretive it is.
Mm-hmm.
But in this world, the government has a full freaking agency. Yeah. To oversee shinobi. That they're basically like, if you don't do your job, I could put you in jail right now. Motherfucker, if they have every government secret on the planet, you should be putting all of them in jail. I hate when I see interesting story elements that just blown to the wind.
Same. That irks me big time.
Ah! I'm sorry. During these tests/investigations, we learn a little more about the slums of Tokyo, about the Shinobi Union's private establishments, and about the Shinobi dark web capable of making government secrets Googleable. The group's investigation eventually takes them to a fighting arena, leading to an impromptu tournament arc against cyborgs and other shinobi from the seminar, with the top prize being information regarding the location of the terrorists. Jin and Kenryu make quick work of every competitor, including the shinobi that they meet in the finals. Jin hesitates when the boss of the arena demands that the victors take the lives of the losing shinobi. But with Kenryu's help, our heroes are able to convincingly fake the deaths of their respected competitors and move on to the terrorist hideout. So, once again, government agency that looks to see if the shinobi are following rules. Private industry that's trying to evaluate shinobi so they see if they follow the rules. And in the exam in which they have to show like whether shinobi are following the rules, they put the shinobi in a death match against each other.
Right.
So what is the point of these government establishments that are acting like, oh, we got to make sure this is up to code and whatnot. I mean, I make sure OSHA doesn't get annoyed about the fact that there's, you know, arena death matches.
it's so awful. But at the same time, it just kind of makes me think of like, all right, Adam, you're working behind the scenes as a stage crew for here in the Chicago Symphony. That's but right. In order to maintain your job, you have to actually go through Takeshi's castle. But the boulders aren't just big styrofoam boulders. They're real. And if you die, uh-huh. You don't get to work here.
I was just about to ask, if I murder competitors, do I get an advantage? Or is that something that doesn't get approved of by the government agency running these Takeshi Castle, Chicago Symphony, private local farmers market obstacle courses?
No, absolutely. And in fact, Kenny Blankenship and Vic Romano both encourage it.
The fact that you remember the fucking names of the hosts makes me love you as a co-host. God bless you. As Jin and the gang make their way to the hideout by car, they're suddenly T-boned by a speeding tractor trailer trap. The terrorists have prepared an ambush for anyone that tries to enter their domain. With quick thinking, the gang is able to sneak into the underground alleys of the slum, where they meet a young, mild-mannered street cook by the name of Kanan. Kanan promises to escort our heroes to the terrorist HQ for a small fee.
Okay, thank you, random man who knows the terrorist HQ. Please take us.
Yeah.
We'll trust you 100%.
Our heroes proceed to beat up the terrorists on their way to the HQ. We learn a little more about the terrorists too, and they are a religious cult, but they're basically Christianity. Like, they're Catholicism. Their leaders are cardinals, and they have a little statue of the Virgin Mary that they're like, oh, I'll do this for you, Mary, and then commit awful atrocities. Jin and Kenryu get severely wounded by child suicide bombers, cementing the leader of this organization onto Jin's shit list. We basically are just running around town getting blown up by children, and eventually En and Kanan get left behind so that the muscle heads of the group can make one last rush at the weapons. However, this proves to be a fatal mistake, as En finally discovers that Kanan is the true leader of the religious fanatics. Jin and the others retrieve the package just in time for them to learn that Kanan and his goons have taken En hostage. So, you know, the one person that you trusted because, like, oh, he's trying his best because he's broke. No, he's an asshole that bombs children, too.
He was actually the bad guy.
Don't ever trust poor people. That's the lesson, y'all.
There you go, kids. That's,
watch out for all those nefarious homeless people, you know.
Oh, boy.
In the final showdown of the arc, Kanan sets the terms for the exchange. En's life for the stolen weapon. To En's dismay, Jin complies. We learn in a quick flashback of earlier in the day that Kenryu had given En an explosive kunai in case he needed to clear out some bad guys. But as he expresses his gratitude to Jin for all he's done for him, En pulls the pin on the explosive and attempts to blow himself up alongside Kanan.
Okay. The bingo card that our listeners have had for a couple weeks, if you had Nationalist Martyrdom on your bingo card, you might have gotten a bingo.
Yeah, this is a very depressing bingo card for this episode, but hey, good for you if you got there. When the dust settles, the end result of the explosion is a severely bloodied Jin, who had pulled the bomb towards his own body before the explosive detonated. Almost every single character in the scene remarks on how cool and brave and amazing Jin is as he proceeds to lecture Kanan. The lecturing had more impact than any beating could, as Kanan accepts his defeat and reflects on where he went wrong as our wounded heroes walk into the horizon, ending this arc.
That's not how it works.
That's not how it works. Here's the thing. Okay. So a big element of this is these religious fanatics use brainwashed kids as suicide bombers in order to deter the shinobi from, you know, enacting their grand plan of blowing a bomb up. And this happens, and Jin says, now I'm pissed. Rightfully so. How the fuck dare you use child martyrdom for your shitty cause, right?
Right.
We get to this hostage exchange then. And it's something that could be seen as like a good parallel, where En says, I believe in this cause enough to blow myself up. And they tease at the idea that, you know, after Jin comes in and saves the day and protects En and whatnot, En's like, God, he's probably furious with me because I shouldn't have risked my life like that. Which makes sense, because he is clearly against childhood martyrdom.
But
when En's like, I'm sorry that I did that, Jin's like, nah, dude, you showed some guts there. Don't feel bad about that. He fucking praises him.
Yeah, he does. He literally does.
He praises him for being a child bomber after talking about how despicable it is to be a child bomber. What are you doing? What is this character?
It's so fucked up.
Because you even bring up the idea that, like, Jin should be pissed. And Jin should be pissed. But you decided because you're such a clever freaking writer, oh, we're going to subvert our expectations and have the responsible adult be like, no, you know what? You're cool and you have autonomy and you got to make that decision for yourself. Da-da-da-da-da. He didn't. He was fucking coerced by you to, like, do the right thing in his mind, which is blow himself up in that instance. How is that any different from the freaking child bombers that you were just going on about, like, oh, I'm going to kill this motherfucker for abusing the autonomy of children? I cannot believe how inept this freaking writer is.
It's...
I'm... Like, that makes sense. The scene, as you expected it to play out, made sense. Jin saves the day. En comes back, is frustrated by his actions, and yeah, Jin goes, don't you ever fucking do that again. That's how the scene should play out, and that's fine. But somebody decided to get way too fucking clever, realized that that would have been the easy way to tell the story, and decided to tell it shitty. All you've done is make his actions equitable to the guy he's currently lecturing for using child bombers for a cause that he sees as righteous. There's literally nothing dividing these guys other than the fact that Jin is cool and Kanan is just a broke loser that should try harder to be as cool as Jin.
It's the great irony of, fuck you, you can't do that, but I'm righteous, I can do it.
Exactly.
It's like, what you're doing is wrong, but if I'm doing it because I'm actually the righteous one, I'm in the right.
Yes.
And that is, oh man, it's so hypocritical. It's so fucked up. But that is actually a philosophy that is in line with a lot of things going on today, and that's probably where it's being pulled from.
I've made this podcast because I want to be creator positive. I want people to learn from people's mistakes, from people's attempts and whatnot. But we are currently going through a cultural reset that makes scenes like this so goddamn frustrating. And I will tell you right now, if you were, you know, somebody that thinks Jin's cool, like, I'm going to do the DARE program. Don't do drugs. Don't bomb yourself for any cause. And don't try to spur kids on and congratulate them for blowing themselves up either.
I'm with you 100%.
That's the end of that arc. We got 5 more chapters.
Yep.
The closing chapters go from chapter 23 to 27. And the next 2 chapters are essentially character retcons for Papillon and Taiga, respectively. First, Papillon visits Jin in the hospital in a romantic comedy subplot where Papillon goes from adamantly rejecting the innuendos of her squad leader to being helplessly attracted to him almost overnight. We're starting to see, like, okay, the few characters that are like, Jin, you need to get your shit together, are actually just Tsundere. And they're like, no, Jin's the coolest, and I have a crush on him, and I want to fuck him.
He really put in the incel dream into the closing chapters. Like, are
they
you
really
serious?
Did.
He really put that in there.
Then the next chapter, Taiga joins Jin on a bureaucratic event that, for whatever reason, results in the typically cold and callous Taiga declaring his undying loyalty to Jin just before getting into an off-screen fight. We get an introduction of a new character 3 chapters before cancellation. The intimidating chief of the Shinobi Union and Jin's mentor, Shimon Karuhabaki. Shimon provides stories of Jin as a rebellious child with no family to the rest of the squad, and more importantly, rumors regarding the secretive crime lord that controls Tokyo in the shadows, known as the Potentate. Shimon informs Jin that the Shinobi Union intends to collect the 5 most powerful Nippon scrolls in order to keep the Potentate in check, including N scroll. When Jin refuses, Shimon challenges him to a fight for the scroll. Shimon, utilizing a stronger electromagnetic power, wipes the floor with Jin. But, and say it with me, folks, with the power of friendship, Jin unlocks a greater potential that allows him to get 1 more blow in for a clash with his master that damages every building in a 2-mile radius.
Of course.
We haven't really talked that much about the arts, and I will say, this one spread, you know, they probably felt like, okay, this is the one big action set piece we'll have in the series, might as well make it a big one. But even then, at the end of the day, it's a beam clash, essentially.
Mm.
If you're wondering why we haven't talked so much about the art, it's because it's fine. It's fine.
It's okay. It's run-of-the-mill. It's nothing outstandingly good, and it's nothing outstandingly bad. It's just mediocre.
The last chapter ends with a time skip of a few years. N is a reliable shinobi now. Jin's squad is equally feared and respected across all of Japan, and the Potentate gathers his allies to enact his grand scheme of destroying the Shinobi Union. Tokyo is on the verge of upheaval. But regardless of what happens, some things never change. The members of the Narumi Kai Shinobi Squad walk forward towards the future, confident that their bonds, founded on truth and honor, will forge the way forward. And that is the end of Tokyo Shinobi Squad. Good.
Finally.
Finally.
Yeet that straight into the sun.
We got a lot to talk about this series, because this brings up very important political discussions in a very ham-fisted way, but we have to recognize that Japanese nationalism has a different tint to it than what we're used to in the States.
Yeah, absolutely. So American nationalism, you see sort of the populism kind of thing, but for Japanese nationalism, it's very similar to the return to form, but it has a more of a historic background. It is not a coincidence from the era that nationalism pulls from to say this is the glorified version of this era that they want to, like, remake, that shinobi get pulled from as sort of the doers of that kind of period, doing what they have to do to make things the way they want it. But additionally, for National Lampoon for Japan, they also see everything and all these influences coming out as an attack on them. And they want to go back to a period where they didn't have as much influence from outside forces than they do now.
It is not my place to really go into political theory, into the dangers and logical fallacies that come with nationalism. There are plenty of political podcasts and plenty of different outlets to receive that education of the history of nationalism, the understanding of globalization, not as a thing that we should try to fight globalization. It's going to happen. There will be good and bad things that come from globalization, but it's as inevitable as automation, right?
Yeah.
So I did not want to have this episode be about how bad nationalism is. But we can have this be a discussion on what kind of writing lends itself towards nationalist ideology. What does nationalism do to the writing process? In that vein, this is actually a super interesting series. It's interesting that we brought up H. Bomber Guy before, because that is actually something I'm going to pull from here, is his video on Control-Alt-Delete,
mm-hmm.
where in that video there's a small review of The Room, or at least like analysis of The Room. And it talks about how Tommy Wiseau is telling the story of what it was like for him to be cheated on, and is telling it in a way that has zero rhetoric in it whatsoever. Zero ability to use cinematic language to convince people of a point.
Yes.
Tommy Wiseau, with The Room, told one of the most honest films ever because it spoke to what his feelings were. That's all Tommy. That's all him just putting his pure feelings with no dilution onto film. And that's why it's a milestone rather than just, oh, it's another bad movie. It's because it's interesting to see the tension of like, oh, this character that feels so hurt by these people and he doesn't know why. And we could see through his inability to express himself exactly why. Like, we kind of get why Tommy Wiseau was cheated on. We could understand why people would feel uncomfortable with that relationship. I think that understanding of The Room is something that can be pulled from in this particular piece. Tokyo Shinobi Squad is to nationalism what The Room is to infidelity. It is a piece of media that is incapable of using its go-to language to dilute an issue down, to use rhetoric to try to seem more convincing. It is just a blatant cry of somebody that wants to write a power fantasy of, I'm nationalist, I don't trust these other cultures, I think the bureaucracy is always in the way, and I think all of you don't like me, but really you actually do, and you all don't, you know, realize how amazing I am. It is the writing of somebody that wants to be taken seriously so freaking badly and wants to stop being laughed at for blaming the world's ills on globalization in a publication that is globalized. And it makes sense that this is how the story is written if this is the ideology that this person wants to defend so strongly. Nationalism is the idea that your culture figured it out and everyone needs to get to your level. I think it's safe to say that there is a level of connective tissue between this person's nationalist ideological beliefs of our country figured it out and everyone needs to get on our level, and this person's desire to write a story in which the main character is just constantly in the right, regardless of what flaws they have, where everyone that is talking shit about him are actually just super enamored by him and they're scared to admit it. If you want an example of what it would be like to live in a nationalist society where nationalist writers are given opportunities to tell the story of nationalism that's focused on, you know, one particular person, this is the most honest telling of that. This is what the nationalist ideology pushes more than anything. I'm not a loser. Please don't think I am. Alex, you can go first on the ranking this time around.
Sure. I'll say a couple other things and I'll give my number. But
absolutely.
Yeah, so as far as, like we said, for the art, it's mediocre. It wasn't anything standing out about it. As far as the story itself, it really doesn't catch you. Like, you know, the setting they set up is flawed. There's not a whole lot of times where you feel anything for the characters. And I wonder why this made it to 27 chapters. I found myself being disillusioned at the end of 5. And then in the cool fashion arc from 6 to 12, wishing it was over, I find myself getting bored with it. I was bored with the powers. I didn't like how every time there was a new Nippon showed that it had to be explained to me. I couldn't just have it be shown through action.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about that is it's the exact thing that My Hero Academia does. When anytime a power shows up, we get an explanation of that power. And, you know, that's another thing is just how derivative everything is. Anything that could be seen as interesting was interesting 5 years ago when it was in Shonen Jump.
Right. A lot of things like that, you know, really bothered me. And I find myself just getting really bored and just being like, man, I want this to be done. So if I were to give this a rating out of 10, geez, I'd put it at, I know there has to be some that are worse. Like there has to be some that are written worse than this. But this is pretty low as it can go. For me, I'd give it a 2.
I don't think there's anything about the series that's redeemable, even without this super distasteful premise. This is a Naruto clone as far as the eye can see. It's a My Hero Academia clone. It takes everything that is interesting about the fighting mechanics and superpowers of this world from other better series. The fact that it rips off from My Hero Academia, which is a series that is based on American Golden Age comic books and was like one of the most pro-globalization series. The absolute balls to steal from that series in particular. You are missing nothing if you do not read this series. There is not anything in the way of action, not anything in the way of writing or character design or conflicts that you couldn't get from any other series. And what this series does that is unique is just unappetizing. It doesn't bode well for the future of Jump if this is how low the bar is for future series.
Right.
Especially when you have hit manga making their way out in the next couple of years, because we're on the verge of a complete cultural shift at Jump, and they need a hit. And they need a hit that will stay there. If this is the kind of material they're looking to help with that, we're in trouble, baby. I'm looking at this series as a 1. I could say there may be 2 or 3 moments that are decent, but they are nowhere near worth the value of reading all 27 chapters of this. I don't see any manga getting any worse than this. So, you know, this is the bar, honestly. This particular series, with its subject matter, comes at a very interesting time. This has been a very weird couple of weeks for manga, and for Shonen Jump in particular. On August 8th, 2020, the writer for Weekly Shonen Jump's hit series Act Age, Tatsuya Matsuki, was arrested for performing indecent acts with a junior high school girl. Shueisha, for their part, acted quickly in gathering the facts and making the call to cancel the series a few days later. This would be where the story begins and ends if this were just an instance of a bad egg abusing his power, but it's not. This is actually the 3rd instance of a popular Jump author being arrested on similar charges while working as a mangaka for Shonen Jump in the last 2 decades. Maybe most distressing of all is the fact that the other 2 mangaka still hold strong working relationships with Shueisha. It really does seem like fate that an act like this that puts the focus of global manga discussion securely on the cultural stigma of pedophilia and sexual abuse in Japan would happen at a time when we here at the Shonen Fiasco Show are working on a review for a manga that vilifies the dangers of every nation that isn't Japan. And we're making this statement not because our country is so star-spangled awesome at stopping child abuse and stopping sexual abuse, especially in our own entertainment industry, but we are making this statement because, as Americans, we know just how easy it is to accept the evils of our culture as an inevitability when they just aren't. As someone that's a diehard fan of Shonen Jump, as somebody that loves the storytelling of this publication, if I could speak directly to the editorial staff, I would really take the opportunity to make my expectations as a fan clear. Pedophiles should not feel comfortable working at Weekly Shonen Jump. Sexual abusers should feel that there are consequences in molesting a child that their status as a famous author for a children's comic series doesn't offset. I can only hope that Shueisha holds firm on their ban of a pedophile this time around, for the first time in 2 decades. It would certainly cross a moral line for me as someone who gushes about Jump manga on a biweekly basis in a public podcast. My heart really does go out to the victims of these acts, and my heart goes out to the absolutely incredible artist of Act Age, Shiro Uzazaki, who absolutely deserves more opportunities to share her art on a global stage in the future. You know, I really hope to see her again with a better writer, with a better story. I still am so on the fence about making that statement on our fun comedy podcast thing. But yeah. I think it needs to be said, especially considering the recency of this and especially, you know, the topic at hand.
Yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Let's go ahead and get to plugs. Thank you so much for listening in to the Shonen Fiasco show. Hey, you know what? If you feel like we got it wrong here, let us know. We're on Twitter, at Shonen Fiasco. Tell us that we really didn't see the merits of the series, because I just want to have that discussion. That is at Shonen Fiasco on Twitter. You'll also be able to see whatever updates that we got going on for future episodes.
The music for this episode's pitch comes from The Game Brass. Is a video game music brass quintet that I play tuba with. And we just finished releasing our third full album. It is Brassino Isles Tropical Cruise. It's a big collab album with 50 musicians, 16 tracks.
Next episode, we will be reviewing The Last Saiyuki.
The last one.
And we're going to be the very last one. And we're going to be trading out nationalists and bureaucrats for cosplayers and cryptids.
Let's go.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Shonen Fiasco show. I am Adam Tetramori.
And I'm Alex Hill.
Be sure to read everything. Get that cough out. Not on my podcast.